Today's episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you by Native and Green Chef. Keep an ear out for promo codes for both these fine sponsors later in the episode. And that episode starts right now.
These are rational human actors who are making predictable economic decisions based on the incentives that are available to them. Decisions that we all might make if we were in the same situation.
Netflix tries on a value-neutral economics of politics approach to illegal substances and the war on them in its new docuseries, The Business of Drugs. Is a worthwhile sit, or should you just say no? Don't get up, I'll fire myself. But first, our cold case topic, Spike Lee's Summer of Sam, is a well-timed testament to the crazy-making properties of a heat wave in New York City. Does it have anything else to tell us about true crime coverage in the Baked Apple? Step into my walk-in freezer for a card game. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 151. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that looks at how true crime is told and sold. I am thrilled to welcome director, editor, and baseball Twitter discourse improver Randy Wilkins to the podcast today. Hello, Randy.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
I am very well, trying not to melt. So let us, without delay, get into our most wanted section. So today, for the most wanted section, we are talking about The Business of Drugs, which dropped on Netflix last week. Here's the case file from the Netflix media site. Quote, "The war on drugs has been raging in America and worldwide for decades, and in the Netflix original series, The Business of Drugs, former CIA officer Amaryllis Fox exposes the chilling economic forces that drive it all. Whether tracking the flow of meth through the jungles of Myanmar or seeking out the roots of the current opioid crisis or investigating the effects of a new legal weed market, the series is a smart, provocative, and raw look into the dark corners of the drug trade." End quote. Okay, so I think for the most part, their self-fluffing description of their series is true, but I did have some notes overall based on what you watched. Randy, what did you think of this series?
I thought it was interesting. I thought it was informative. As a filmmaker, I didn't necessarily find it overly creative. I'm not totally sure that it had a very specific perspective. I think that there were moments where they were trying to offer up a particular point of view, but it felt very much bird's eye view viewpoint and just giving the clinical and formula approach to telling this story. And I thought it was fine. I did learn a bunch of things, but I'm not totally sure that I knew how anybody felt about what they were reporting. So as a filmmaker, I think I would have asked for more on the point of view side of things. But I thought it was good. I thought it was informative. It definitely taught me a few things that I didn't know going into watching the series.
Yeah, same here. Because I watch so much of this genre of content, I'm always looking for how they can give me a little more processy stuff, whether it's the economics of certain kinds of crime, if it's the economics of law enforcement, if it's like price stabilization of cocaine. Like I don't think I realized I wanted to know more about that until it came up. So I did think that this did that differently in terms of approaching drugs as a like value neutral economic prospect that is subject to many of the same market forces as like IKEA, which actually is a comparison that they explicitly make. So I want to play a clip from episode one, which is about cocaine, which talks about why cocaine pricing remains relatively stable, which is not something I admit I have thought much about, but here is a Yale economist who, like, that's all he does, and he's going to tell us about it in clip two.
The price of cocaine in the U.S. has stayed incredibly stable for a long time. The price of almost nothing else has.
This is not a market where people compete necessarily on price. Rather, people compete on the reliability with which they can serve the market. So let's start with the consumers. The way consumers choose their dealer is somebody who can reliably give them their drugs and who's not going to be changing price a lot. The price of each gram of cocaine have stayed at around $100 for over 25 years. An analogy would be in the video game industry, where the prices of video games have stayed constant around $60 per game for a very long time. And it's certainly not because technology has not evolved. It's because the price of $60 per game gives you a very effective coordination mechanism for how much they should expect to pay for the next video game. When we translate it to a market like cocaine, and that's good practice both for consumers but also for the organizations themselves because it's so dependent on reliability.
I just really found it refreshing that he was referring to drug dealing and distribution organizations as like analogous to, I don't know, the Y, the Knights of Columbus. Like, well, I mean, but at the same time, of course. But I think that that was a fun explanation for behavioral economics geeks like myself. But I'm not, I mean, did you feel that that part of it was accessible?
No. I understand it in logic, and I understand that that's the actual reality of how that market works, but it was hard for me to wrap my head around the fact that the price is solely dependent on a reliable process and not a reliable product. So it's clear in the show that, and they don't really harp on this, but it feels clear that some cocaine is better than others. And it seems like the focus for this show was on the highest grade or like purest form of cocaine that went to the customers. And it just feels like to me, why would somebody, now I'm not an economist, I don't pretend to be one, I don't know everything about markets and behavioral economics and all that stuff, but it makes sense to me that I would pay a certain amount for the quality of a product versus paying for a product that doesn't give me the same bang for my buck, if that makes sense.
So, logically,
it made sense to me and I was following it, but I was just really surprised that, let's just say a customer is willing to pay the same amount when the quality of the product might vary from dealer to dealer. I mean, not everybody's getting the best stuff, quote unquote. So I found that interesting, and that was something that I kept going back to while I was watching these episodes, just how much there's a trust in the black market that I didn't expect to exist before I watched the show.
Right. I was quite impressed by the access that they got to people on the sort of, quote, wrong side of the law, regardless of which drug they were talking about. And in the cocaine episode, which is the first one in the series, they open talking to a dealer who is, I mean, obviously this was not made terribly recently, but he is like COVID bandana masked up to disguise his identity, which was kind of interesting. But and there was a funny bit in there about the relationship to Avon, and I think his father's relationship to their Avon lady, which was not necessarily about lipstick. But I kind of wish that they had come back around and spent more time with that guy at the end, because if cocaine's price is that reliant on reliability, okay, but what if the reliable part of it is that it's been cut to hell with baking soda or whatever? Like, if it's reliably bad, doesn't that change the equation? And wouldn't this guy who does this who was like right up close on the ground to supply and demand locally, wouldn't he have something to say about that? So I kind of wanted them to get more into that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. It just seems that there's an assumption that reliability equals a good product.
Right.
And that can't be the case with every dealer. I mean, and the example you bring up is a great one in that we don't really know the quality of the guy's product. Like, they don't really get into it. They don't tell us through customers or through the dealer himself, does he have the best stuff in his market, in his neighborhood, and amongst
his customers.
If they had
been able to do that.
Yeah, it would have been incredible.
Now, there's a documentary.
But I mean, it's, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it just seems that it was very clinical in its presentation of how this economic system works, but it seemed like there was a layer missing, that it just felt very much reliant upon giving these facts, but not necessarily translating it into how it actually works on a day-to-day, in the day-to-day business of these transactions. Because again, it's just hard to believe that $60 gets you the same quality across the board. And there's and I'm sure that part of this is just access and what they can put on the screen and what they can't, but there's like a human element that seems to be missing. And the host hints at it. She hints at it, which I thought was, it was really going to get into the morality of doing this, where some people are forced to do things that you and I might initially believe is the quote unquote wrong thing to do. But as we learn their stories, we realize that they're not bad people. They're just making certain decisions for their own, the benefit of their own lives. But we don't really get into that. It's just, it's thrown in there. We see this dealer from Compton, and then it gets completely away from the human element of it. And I wish that we had more of that.
Yeah, I agree. Because I think going back to what you were saying about point of view, I think Amaryllis Fox, she does seem to come back frequently to the fact that she was kind of like embedded overseas in the war on terror, and that she is extrapolating a lot of lessons learned in that to the war on drugs, which, whatever, was lost before it started. And there are moments when it seems like she's really about to go off on a rant, which, good, please, like, make it personal and like have a direct feeling about this. But then it never quite coheres in that way. And I think she is personally invested in this subject, but it wasn't necessarily coming through in each episode, which they tended to be, even though the information was new and they had good access, they tended to be sort of structured in a fairly predictable way and drawing fairly predictable conclusions. I don't know if you felt the same.
I agree. I mean, the conversation about, or the repeated returns to the war on drugs, I felt were always like teases. I thought that she was going to put her expertise in being a former CIA analyst into the story, and it never happens. It just says that it's basically, I know this stuff, but I'm not going to share it with you.
Yeah.
So I don't know if, I'm not sure if it was a legal thing or she was not allowed to do those things, but I don't understand why she was teasing us with it and then would just pull back. And they had all the clips of Ronald and Nancy Reagan doing the signing of the war on drugs, all the legislation for the war on drugs in the second episode, when they were talking about synthetics and how that impacted research, which I've found fascinating, but it doesn't really jump into how devastating that legislation really ended up being. And it feels like the host knows more than she's letting on.
Yeah.
And it feels like, well, yeah, are you going to tell us or are you not going to tell us? Like, what is the relevance of your history fighting the war on terrorism and have this information about the war on drugs if you're not going to share it? Like, if we keep going to this clinical approach to just tell us how the industries work.
Yeah, she mentions like immediately within the first 3 minutes, I'm going to say, that she built and deployed some kind of algorithm vis-a-vis the war on terror. And then I kept waiting for like three episodes for like the second part of that sentence, which is, and here's the version I built to try to, you know, predict behaviors of drug markets or behaviors of foreign distributors. And then it never came. And I was like, so you have it, but you're not allowed to tell us, which is exactly what you said.
Right. It didn't seem, it ended up not being relevant when it should have been the foundation of the storytelling.
Yeah.
Because what are we, where are we arriving at? Like, what is, why are we watching this? You know, I find the clinical aspect of it really fascinating. And it was really interesting to see a Yale professor know so much about the drug industry.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure where it leads us to. You know, like I'm not sure what the bow on it is.
Well, and he's kind of the first one to get emotional, I would say, about the disproportionate ill effect that drugs being a black market and being illegal have on the poor communities that have no choice but to serve this market. He's specifically talking about Colombian growers, but this is a pretty broad statement that he's making in the clip I'm about to play. And I feel like if this is the point of the series, which, because this comes up again, I think it may be that they needed to kind of shift their storytelling to make that clearer. But here's clip three.
This line of what's legal and what's illegal for them, it's pretty irrelevant, because when the government comes to them and says, like, well, what you're doing is illegal, they can say, well, who the fuck are you? Like, I've never seen you here. You've never cared about us for anything. And so your definition of legal means nothing to me.
I mean, this is a guy who seems to take that very personally, and that was interesting to me. But then that angle seems to, they like shift away from that angle for a while, which I thought was a pity.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to willingness to be committed to a point of view. And I think there are a lot of teases to that. And I thought that moment was really compelling. Also, the professor, the Colombian professor, who talked about how the government just isn't capable and doesn't have the agency or resources to really combat the coca market,
right?
Even though they're trying, they just don't have the infrastructure to really overwhelm the bad farming that's going on. So I thought that the clip that you just played and the interview with the Colombian professor was really interesting in that sense. And also the trafficker who puts the cocaine in the stuffed animal,
his
story was really interesting. I just wish that there was more of that, especially because they are with this trafficker going to the coordinates that the cartels told him to drop off the cocaine. And you know, he's putting his life in his own hands every night.
Yeah.
And I thought that we needed more of that, because then it becomes a moral dilemma. He knows that it's wrong, but is it really wrong? Because that's the only occupation that he can take where he can provide for his family. It's the same thing with the farmers in the mountains who build this lab about 1,000 feet or whatever it was away from
right.
The Colombian police, like, ripping up all the crops.
Yeah, so, and that the Colombian army has to go out there with, like, actual shovels, because they can't.
Right.
They tried dropping weed killer on it, and then that turned out to be not so ethical. Go figure.
Mm-hmm.
So they're at, like, out there digging it up plant by plant, and it's like, this is not the solution. But particularly in the case of that guy who's, like, you know, cutting open a stuffed sparkly kitty and filling it with cocaine and then re-sewing it, that the idea of his quitting...
Right.
Is not Like, never mind the fact that it is the only sort of practicable way for him to provide for his family, but like, quitting is not something that you're allowed to do. Like, once you're in the supply chain, you don't get to, like, they're not going to jump you out. So,
right. So, and it also doesn't explain totally why that port city is so poor. Like, it says that there's a large gap of inequality, but it doesn't explain why, or at least I don't remember the reasons why that was the case. Which I feel like was one piece of information that really could have connected a lot of things. Because I'm not really sure why, if this is such a major port city, why is everybody surrounding it that lives in that area so poor as compared to other parts of the country? And maybe I missed it.
I don't know. I don't think you did. I think that this is something that they suggested a possible answer to the question for in a later episode where they're talking about how drug money is laundered in big sort of mm-hmm. juncture cities. And we have a clip for that, which I'll play later. But yeah, this is, again, a point of view problem, perhaps, that it's like, do you want to focus on one city? Do you want to focus on like a couple of connected links in the chain of production? It just seemed like maybe they were trying to get their arms around way too much. And that's that.
I agree.
And that's why there's maybe a slight lack of focus. Speaking of a slight lack of focus, that terrible segue means it's time for a word from one of our sponsors, Native Deodorant. I believe deodorant performance matters, particularly on a day like today, which, as we're recording it, is what I like to call a three-shirt day weather-wise. Actually, that's just what I do call it. There's no liking weather like this for a perspiration-forward lady like myself. And there's no using a deodorant that punches out at 11:30 a.m. either. So I've wanted to switch to a more natural product for a while, but it has to do its job keeping me smelling fresh all day. That's why I want to recommend that you check out Native. Why? Native deodorant doesn't just block odor better, it's made better. Native has ingredients you've actually heard of. You don't need a degree in chemical engineering to read the label and find coconut oil, shea butter, and tapioca starch. It's also vegan, and it's never tested on animals. Native never uses ingredients like aluminum, parabens, sulfates, or talc. And if you think switching to an aluminum-free deodorant means you have to sacrifice on odor protection, not so. Native will keep you smelling and feeling fresh all day long. Native even has a newsletter that, among other things, has advice on transitioning away from traditional aluminum-adjacent deodorants. And with over 10 scents, including rotating seasonals, Native has something for everyone. Their most popular classic scents are coconut and vanilla, lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and citrus and herbal. I'm a fan of the first one, coconut and vanilla, because it pairs well with the scent of the sunscreen I am also ladling on by the handful at this time of year. But the scents are also subtle and unintrusive. You're not going to fill an elevator with the smell of fruit or leaves. And they're not fakey. Want to see for yourself what Native's more than 14,000 five-star reviews love so much? Trying Native is risk-free. Every product comes with free shipping within the U.S. and free 30-day returns and exchanges. Do what I did and make the switch to Native today by going to nativedo.com/blotter or use promo code blotter at checkout and get 20% off your first order. That's nativedo.com/blotter or use promo code blotter at checkout. That's B-L-O-T-T-E-R. For 20% off your first order. Thanks, Native. All right, back to the equally lack of focused business of drugs. It's actually not that bad. It's a well-made thing. It's just a little bit dry at times, except when at the end of an episode, Amaryllis Fox is trying, I think, to provide a like grand unifying statement. In my opinion, this doesn't go particularly well, especially at the end of episode one, where I feel like maybe we're being scolded for not being ethical cocaine consumers. I have a clip, and you can tell me if you agree with me on that.
Friday and Saturday nights, people are at parties, they're at clubs, they're ordering Coke on their cell phone, they're buying blow on the street corner. And what they don't know or refuse to acknowledge is that ultimately they're funding a chain of human suffering with that choice.
This is a global, multi-billion dollar business built on the backs of the poor.
In my experience in the field, over years of service, I've realized you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again when you keep seeing the data to show that it doesn't work. We're $10.5 billion into the war on drugs in Colombia alone. 500,000 Colombians have died. And last year, more cocaine shipped than ever before.
I mean, she's not wrong about any of this, but I'm not sure what we, the viewer, are expected to take from that. Like, buy locally? I mean, not to be flip, but like, are you against big cocaine? Is it the war on drugs you're against? Do you feel like people are going to stop midline while watching this and be like, you know, I've been so wrong about the deleterious downhill effects of this market? I mean, I think she feels strongly. I'm just not sure what she feels strongly about is the issue.
I think one issue that I had with the end of the Kane episode and the scolding that you referenced is there is no mention of accountability for the people that are actually a part of the pipeline. So there isn't, not every single person that's a part of the production and trafficking of cocaine to all of the customers are good people or are necessarily poor. They're right. Not everyone is being taken advantage of. And there are some people in the episode who clearly just bought in and wanted to do it and did it for selfish and greedy reasons. And they understand the risk and they don't care. And they don't care that this is being delivered to customers worldwide or that they themselves are exploiting people like the guy who's stuffing the stuffed animals with cocaine or
right.
The little kids on the street that are lookouts for when the police come. They don't care about that. And to put all of the accountability and responsibility on the viewer, but also the customer, when for an hour you were just breaking down the economics of the process and talking about the reliability of the prices. And that's why, you know, it's such a impressive economic industry. I don't think you can do all of that and then at the end wag your finger at everybody and say it's your fault why all these right. people are dead in the street. And it's like, how, I mean, you worked for the CIA. Why didn't you stop it? What did your algorithm tell you and the organization about stopping this? It's like you were in a position to really make some change and you didn't do it. And in many ways, if you really want to get into the nitty gritty of it, you can say that funding from the US like helps keep this industry alive in a lot of different ways. So I'm not sure why there was the finger pointing at the end of the episode without acknowledging the entire picture of how all of this works and who's really involved and who's doing what.
Yeah, there's that. And there's the, you know, you get up to a certain point in the pyramid, for lack of a better term, but that's the term they use. So let's go with it. And there you are at the cartels. And then all of a sudden the subject is changed to something else. It's as though the cartels are like this intractable topographical feature of the world that can't be moved. So they don't discuss it, which I think I didn't really realize until just now, now that we're talking about it, that the conversation gets as far as the cartels. And then they're kind of like, well, cartels, am I right? And you're like, well, yes, right. But like, you know, it could be pointed out that that's where a lot of responsibility also lies, for certainly the, you know, the dangers involved for, among other people, the stuffed animal courier guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think the reason why they don't go into that realm is because of the access that they have.
Yeah.
And the threat of, you know, retribution if they violated the trust that they clearly created to get access to the process. And, you know, it's similar to baseball. It's taken in that direction. You have all these writers and national reporters who break news and rarely criticize team owners in public, you know, and the answer is obvious because they don't want to lose their pipeline of information. And it's the same thing here. I mean, we get the hint of a cartel, but they're never really mentioned in this. It's all the guys who are on the ground, who have their boots on the ground and are really putting their lives in danger to make this process work. But we don't hear from like the CEO of the company, or there's no mention of the CEO of the company. And I'm sure that is an access thing, and also a looming threat that if you were to take it there, you know, there might not be another season. You know what I mean?
Right. So, yeah.
I'm sure that's where the integrity of the show is in the balance, because this entire show is predicated on access that not many people can get.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that has a lot to do with it.
Well, look, I know you didn't explicitly compare Rob Manfred to a Sinaloan straw man, but I'm not angry at it either way. Because, I mean, really, like, sometimes you listen to Buster Olney being like, it's hard to know what Manfred's thinking, and it's like, it's really not. What he's thinking is that he doesn't like baseball very much, and if someone would just say that,
right,
it would save us all a lot of trouble.
Right.
Oh, I mean, yeah, absolutely. That's such a good comparison, truly. That's going to stick with me forever. I'm going to play one more clip, which is in the meth episode, which is episode 4. And it's not they don't go in a direction that you expect with this episode, because they're in Myanmar talking about the, like, that's the sort of Southeast Asian, Chinese, Australian hub for meth. It starts out as pills mixed with caffeine. And then sort of very early in the chain, it becomes a way for blue collar workers to work extra shifts. So there is this sense of like that they need to unionize against these meth and caffeine pills. But there's also this whole city that's springing up around the money that's being laundered after the transaction. So here's a sort of brief explainer of why drug cartels worldwide might use real estate to launder their money in clip 6.
This new skyline may look worlds away from the ethnic militias and their meth trade, but in a country where fewer than 15% of people have bank accounts, real estate plays a critical role in holding and laundering the illegal proceeds that come from the sale of narcotics. In Myanmar's cash economy, real estate gives drug traffickers the opportunity to launder profits into steel and concrete.
Money launderers are using the real estate market because it's one of the easiest markets to absorb large quantities of investment. If I'm a narco trafficker and I put money into luxury vehicles, there is a depreciation factor every year. In immovable property, every year there will be an appreciation.
And as long as the taxes are paid, the government makes virtually no attempt to trace the money trail.
Well, yeah, which is something that you could probably just as easily say about certain American criminal concerns, leaving aside the current executive branch, because I don't want to be renditioned out of my office. Yeah, I thought that was, once again, that's good information. I wouldn't have thought of that. I wouldn't have looked at construction, like, I don't know, living in New York City, growing up around here, like, Is construction corrupted? Yes, but that's not necessarily the direction from which it's corrupted. So this was good information, but I wanted them to push it a little further and be like, okay, once you have the money in there, when is it considered clean? How do you get it out? How much of the government's turning a blind eye is assisted with cash donations? So right. I was just hoping for a little bit more each time, but this is a really informative series. I just think it needed to, I'm not sure what, make each episode either a little longer or a little shorter and really get into one aspect of each story a little more completely.
Yeah, I think it was, for me, it's just perspective. I mean, if you make it longer or shorter, you could just get more of the same or less of the same.
Yeah.
It just seems like there is a clear choice to focus on the very clinical, informative aspect of how this works. And part of it might just be because that's their angle to make the show stand out from something else. Like, even though this is scripted, like, you could just watch Narcos if you wanted to get the emotional arcs that we're talking about.
Yeah. But or Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad or certain arcs in The Sopranos. Yeah.
Right. So I think part of it might have just been, this is our angle. We have access that other producers, other shows don't have. And we just want to really make the case that these are economic systems unlike any other legal economic system that we come across in our day-to-day lives. And I think in that respect, it's an incredibly successful and productive series. I just think that you have to go into it understanding that this is more about information and not about judgment or conclusions.
Right.
You know, like, it's, you have to arrive at your own feelings about it based on the information and access that they provide, which I think it's fine. I mean, I like the show. It's just that I thought that there were teases in there, again, as I said before, where it felt like there was going to be a perspective on it, and then they just kind of pulled back. So it's almost as if I would have just appreciated them just being even more clinical if they weren't going to go in the point of view direction.
Right, and not sort of tempt us with information that is not coming. Before we move on from this, it's just occurred to me, I'm wondering if, like, just completely sort of reorganizing, like using a completely different organizing principle for the series might have let them give us more of what we wanted. Because, like you, I like the show, but I wanted more from it. So it's really not possible, I think, for them to organize it any other way but, like, buy one different kind of drug or class of drug per episode, right? But if they had done it like, oh, well, here's a sort of like longitudinal look at production. And then episode two is distribution. And then episode three is like a border law enforcement contact. Do you think that is either workable or like changes anything? Or is that a dumb idea? It's probably a dumb idea.
I think it's a good idea. I think it's very clear that they just did not want to add a perspective to it.
Yeah.
For various reasons. You know, it was probably pitched that way. It probably jeopardizes their access.
Yeah.
I think there are far more logistical than creative reasons why they went in the direction that they went.
Yeah, I think you're right. All right, well, folks, that's The Business of Drugs. That is on Netflix, currently available. It's 6 episodes. And yeah, I recommend it, but, you know, be aware that it has some limitations, which are, when you think about them, pretty understandable. All right, speaking of the million stories available, let's move on to the cold case section. We We are talking about Summer of Sam, a Spike Lee joint from 1999. Here's the case file from Rotten Tomatoes for whatever it's worth. Quote, New York City's infamous summer of 1977 was a scene of disco divas and the culture clash between fashionable patrons of Studio 54 and the new wave of punk rockers who invaded Manhattan. Wow. All right, continuing. It was also one of the hottest summers on record and produced the city's first serial killer, whom the tabloids, in a frenzy to boost their circulations, quickly dubbed Son of Sam. With the media playing an integral role in creating mass fear and paranoia, the whole city became a hotbed of trepidation and panic, captivating not only New York, but the entire world. End quote. I'm not really sure that's about any movie in particular, but okay. Summer of Sam did come out in 99, like I said. I saw it during a heat wave, just like 77's. And just like the one we're sweating out right now, everyone I saw it with thought it was a mess, and most contemporary reviews concurred. But I have always felt that Summer of Sam is, if not underrated exactly, then under-discussed. And I am really glad that you're here to talk about it with me, even though it's not strictly speaking true crime. I think it connects up with things that I tend to talk about in this podcast. So let's start out pretty broad. How familiar are you with the film, and when's the last time you had watched it before watching it for this?
Before getting ready for this podcast, I hadn't watched it in a bunch of years. I saw it not when it came out, I saw it a couple years after, and then I've seen clips over the years, and when I've seen the clips is more from a filmmaker breakdown perspective, not necessarily watching it just for the story itself,
right.
Because I think that cinematically it's really, really well done, and really, really creative. So in terms of looking at it as an overall narrative, I hadn't watched it in that context for years, prior to preparing for our discussion today.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't either. And as I was watching it again, I remember at the time that I was like, oh, sweet, 2.5 hours in this glorious air conditioning. Whatever happens. That's awesome. But when I was watching it again in my sweaty office, I really was not feeling the runtime. And I don't think as a narrative, at least from a linear perspective, that's the point of it at all. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also know just from experience that any narrative film that Spike does, the running time is going to be on the longer side. He just likes to tell his stories with a lot of time. I mean, he just lets it play out. So the running time itself, I guess specifically for Spike, didn't really factor into anything.
Right.
Just because I'm used to it working with him and knowing his films. So, you know, I expect them to be long. If they're shorter, I'm surprised.
And, right.
That's just his approach to filmmaking. So I, you know, it didn't factor in to me at all in any shape or form, just because of my familiarity with him. So yeah, it didn't really, and there's a lot going on in the film, so I didn't even really notice the runtime, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't either, but it also didn't feel to me like, I mean, I think that sort of contemporary critical knock on it is that it was overstuffed and unfocused, but I did not get that feeling from it at the time, and I didn't get that feeling from it rewatching it. Because, like I said, I don't think like a sort of linear document about Son of Sam is the point. But I think it may have been the point, because I think that originally the film was supposed to be more about the crimes, and then was pulled away from that because victims' families were not crazy about the idea. I don't know how true that is. But I think that's a really different film. What did you feel specifically from a filmmaker standpoint, I guess, but any standpoint, about specifically the sections dealing with Berkowitz, like communicating with the dog and freaking out in his room?
I thought it was accurate and a creative take on a mythology of the Son of Sam. I think that, you know, we just talk so much about point of view for the business of drugs, and I think that this took a very specific point of view and playing up this idea that he was hearing voices in his head and the dog was like really pushing him to do it. And I found that interesting. I didn't live during that time, so I wasn't as familiar with the overall story of David Berkowitz, so I'm not sure what other approaches or motifs Spike could have used to communicate it. But I think this speaks also to what you just mentioned about people criticizing it as being a mess and unfocused. I think what those criticisms miss is that period of time was
a mess and unfocused.
Was a mess. Yeah. The whole time was a mess. So I think that Spike actually really captured it really well, because there were a million and one things happening in the late 70s in New York City. So it's difficult to streamline everything and make it this tidy box when that would be an inaccurate representation of what was happening in New York City. Like, the Bronx was burning, the city was broke, Summer Sam, disco, the rise of punk and CBGBs. There's so many things happening in New York, and it was such the blackout. There were so many transformative moments. It's almost as if 2020 right now, you know, like, we can easily say 2020 is a transformative moment, not just in New York City, but across the world, and make that comparison to the late 70s of New York City. There's so many things happening that if you cut out one of those factors, then you're not really telling the story, honestly, in my opinion. My parents have told me a lot about that time period, and the film seems to have captured that really well, and then rooted it in a confusing, messy relationship, you know, and this like search for identity for John Leguizamo's character and Adrian Brody's character. It just, I find the criticism completely void of recognizing the time that the film is capturing. And it's also, I know for a fact, a time when Spike learned or realized he wanted to be a filmmaker. So he got a Super 8 millimeter camera from a friend of his who just gave it to him, and the blackout happened. And he was either a freshman or a sophomore at Morehouse College, and he used this Super 8 camera to film the blackouts.
Right.
So part of the reason, I think, I don't know this for a fact, but part of the reason why he plays the reporter is because he was, as a young filmmaker finding himself, he was the reporter in his own mind of the blackouts in New York City.
Right.
And then he came back, and that was essentially the first film that he ever made. And I think that period of time is very important in his life. And I think that he understood it so well because his feet were on the ground. He was out there literally filming the chaos. So right. I think that this film captures a feeling that he had at that time. So to say that, you know, the film is a mess just isn't accurate. I mean, the time was a mess. You know, if you make a film about 2020, 5 years from now, if that film doesn't have this chaotic, frenzied energy, you didn't capture it well enough, in my opinion. So
yeah. No,
the criticism to me doesn't fit.
I mean, I would agree. I also feel like it's not like you have to meet a work where it is, and where this is right. is more, not collage, but like kaleidoscope, I guess. And that also, it's so gross when people say this about things, but it's so true of this particular movie, and it's why I've always really admired it. I feel like nobody can render on screen to the point of almost it being in smell-o-vision what it is like to be in New York City in the summertime, like Spike Lee, and what, like, what this city is, and the little, whatever, like, the good version of a trigger is, if you grew up in this area, and just, like, the sounds and the headlines and the familiar figures. I just think that this movie is such a document of that time, which, like, you know, I was alive, but I was in pre-K, so my understanding of what was really happening was nil. But can I, do I have sense memories of Reggie Jackson doing things? Yes, I do. So I'm going to play two clips from early-ish in the movie that are just very New York-y things that always make me feel seen when he puts them into movies like this.
Today, things are much different. Business is booming up, up, and up. Crime is down, down, down. Homicides are the lowest it's been since 1961. Well, it wasn't always like this. This film is about a different time, a different place. The good old days. The hot, blistering summer of 1977. There are 8 million stories in the Naked City, and this was one of them.
That's Mr. Jimmy Breslin, and of course, the dog. And here's a little snippet of 1010 Wins.
All news, all the time. This is WINS. You give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world.
Wins news time at the tone, 3 o'clock. It happened again last night. More terror, more bloodshed. The .44 caliber killer striking again, leaving two more dead. The police have recovered a note.
That little sound cue is like just in my bone marrow, honestly, having grown up around here, like Jimmy Breslin, living in the city in the late 90s, and I don't know, all of the people who were like, I miss old Times Square. Like, really? you
<Right. laughs>
Like, no one misses anything about Times Square ever, in my opinion, no. Except perhaps Broadway. But yeah, there's really this sense, even if you weren't alive or only dimly remembered the city at that time, I think there is like absolute trust with the audience that Lee is going to give you that, just like the sensations, like the sensory feeling of being in your living room in the Bronx, surrounded by 78 box fans, just trying to get through. So I don't think that it needs to be this like stately, linear, procedural, the way, I mean, I revere the movie Zodiac, but it's just a completely different experience. And I don't think it needs to be as orderly as that, because the time was not orderly, like you said.
Right. And I also think that people aren't paying attention to the title of the film. It's called Summer of Sam.
Yeah.
It's not called Son of Sam. It's Summer of Sam. So the Son of Sam is one piece of the narrative. It's the cohesive kind of center point, but it's really a discussion about that summer in New York City. You know, it's in the title. So I feel like when people criticize the film in that context, they just weren't paying attention to the details. You know, it's a conversation about a formative time in Spike's life, and the anchor point is the Son of Sam, and then it goes from there. Because I think it's just, again, a New York story that is a part of a larger chronicle of Spike's stories about New York City. You know, it's 25th Hour is about Ed Norton's character, you know, his last day before going to jail, but it's also about 9/11.
Right.
And I mean, you see that throughout all of the stories that he tells about New York. It's this grounded, emotional, personal, intimate story, but there's a much larger cultural context with those narratives. And I think Summer of Sam is just another example of that. So I, I understand criticizing the film, but I don't understand that specific criticism. It just doesn't, it doesn't match up for what the film is and the time that it's talking about. I mean, it says it in the title that it's about this summertime in New York City. It's not necessarily about the Son of Sam murders. So,
yeah, no, I agree. And I also think that in some ways, like decentering the actual crimes and the actual crime story, like gives you more information and obviously more context, because you are sort of irising out to look at the community and how the city was responding and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, like, I think sometimes with true crime stories, like, there's only so many things that you can say to a string of murders that to people who do not think like psychopaths are senseless. Like, you can't really analyze it much further beyond the facts that we know. So the more useful and compelling way into the story is to put it into context instead and see how it was affecting the community for good or ill or completely insane in this case. None of those responses read as not genuine to me either. Like, I think all of the sort of community, all the sections of the community that he's looking at, sort of they felt, if that makes any sense. Like, were there any aspects of the other parallel stories that you felt didn't work, or do you think they all have to kind of be taken holistically here?
I think they have to be taken holistically. There are moments watching it and watching it again where I did wonder, well, why is this happening? Why are we seeing this? But by the time you get to the end, it makes total sense.
Right.
You know, there's a paranoia, there's a loyalty to the neighborhood, a loyalty to each other, a very narrow view of what your identity is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a slow creep to that point. So there's so many layers to it, and this issue of identity, especially in the Italian American community, is I think a prominent storyline in the film, and I think that it pops up in so many different areas, whether it's Adrian Brody's love for punk rock music, Ruby changing her hair and feeling free being a part of that scene, John Leguizamo being a serial cheater, and Deanna going along with it but also finding herself and her voice, the mob guys feeling like they have some loyalty to their community but they're taking like a real violent tack to keep that in check and honor that. I think identity is like a large portion of this, and I think that it unfolds slowly, but I think that the payoff comes at the end. And it's driven by this paranoia of the Son of Sam. So I think it weaves together really nicely, and I think that it all makes sense. So I think that there might be moments where you're like, well, where is this headed? Why are we seeing this? But then when we get to the end, I think it all comes together quite well, actually. I mean, I think that I agree with you that I think that this is one of Spike's under-discussed films, and I think it's one of his better films, to be quite honest.
I want to talk a little bit about the questions of identity and the ways that people are sometimes like locked into, or the characters feel like they're locked into lanes. And can't really, like, they could sort of see each other alongside each other, but they're not necessarily able to break out. And particularly when that comes to the Italian American guys, Don Gazzara, I called him in our notes, and like interacting with the police and how that all got braided together. But first, I'm going to have to braid our discussion together with a word from another sponsor, Green Chef. Green Chef is a USDA-certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Green Chef lets you choose from a wide array of easy-to-follow lifestyles with select organic ingredients. Meal plans include paleo, plant-powered, keto, and balanced living. And the recipes are quick and easy with step-by-step instructions and photos. And the ingredients come pre-measured, perfectly portioned, and mostly prepped. This is a great time to try Green Chef, not least because it offers contactless delivery and offsets 100% of its direct carbon emissions and plastic packaging in every box, so you can skip the grocery store and keep your carbon footprint small. More to the point, if you're like my household, you've been doing a lot more of your own cooking since the middle of March, and you're pretty much down to the same two or three dinners over and over. Green Chef lets you eat well and discover new recipes every week, and you get to skip the Googling for new dishes and the scouring the neighborhood for a seasoning you'll never use again. And you can switch up your meal plan whenever you want as well. I will probably be sticking with the plant-powered box for a while because the meals have come out so well, and I am neither a natural in the kitchen nor blessed with much free time, but Green Chef's linguine with basil pesto made me look and feel like a pro. It only took 40 minutes, and it incorporated kale in a way that wasn't the same old, endless chewing. And I wouldn't have thought to stuff a pepper myself, ever, but the veggie and bean stuffed peppers were cinchy and delicious. I also enjoy that there are occasional little warnings in the recipes for accidental chefs like myself who sometimes forget to put the oven mitt back on. They're written very encouragingly, and everything is clearly marked, including the tools you'll need, and any prospective allergens. I doubt anyone within the sound of my voice is allergic to saving money, so let's get that done. Use code BLOTTER80 to get $80 off your first month of Green Chef, plus free shipping on your first box. Go to greenchef.com/blotter80 to redeem and for more details. That's greenchef.com/BLOTTER80 for $80 off your first month and free shipping. Thanks, Green Chef. And we're back. I have a clip from the scene where the cops go to Ben Gazzara to basically ask him to put the word out that they're looking for the .44 caliber killer. He has some things to say about community policing that don't go over well, but it's also in dialogue a very economical summation of the braiding together of organized crime and policing and longtime locals in a pretty short amount of time. So here's clip 9.
I'm asking you, this guy, how many people did he kill? 3, 4, 5. And with no disrespect, detective, in Harlem last night, your people, the coloreds, how many of each other did they kill? 7, 8?
8, 9 at least. And on Saturday, 20, if we're lucky.
So, why didn't you ask me who killed them? Eh? Not enough press in it for you? Not enough Post or Daily News headlines?
Look, there's a homicidal maniac running around the neighborhood. You don't want to do anything about it?
You have been busting my balls ever since you got promoted. Now, why is that? Wasn't I good to you when you were a kid?
And then there's a line about him getting Mickey Mantle to sign his baseball. I went back and rewatched this scene a couple of times because I thought it so elegantly compressed so much of what that time was about, vis-a-vis law, quote, enforcement, unquote. Did you find that scene as striking as I did, including, by the way, the little Godfather oboe in the background that I just noticed?
I did. And I also don't think that it's merely a reflection of that time. I mean, I think that
well, yeah,
fits now. I mean, like, we're living in another time of figuring out the role of the police in our society as we speak. So I think that's one of the best scenes in the film. I like the honesty of it. I like that it has both perspectives going at the same time. Like there isn't a fear of ruffling any feathers when they talk about black on black crime or loyalty to your own, loyalty to your community and the dynamics of growing up in particular Italian American neighborhoods. I just think it captures a lot. There's a lot of layers there and perfectly captures America, really. America really in the 20th and 21st century.
Yeah.
So I think that that's one of those scenes where it makes Spike's work timeless because we can easily, instead of 1977, 1978, we can easily say that that's 2020
or yeah, for sure.
2016 or 1999. You know, I don't think that it's specific to any time era in New York City or in America, really, for the last however many decades that all this stuff has been going on. So, yeah, I think it's a great scene. I forgot about that scene for some reason, but then when I watched it again, it really resonated with me for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, I had forgotten that scene too, and I had forgotten that, everyone is in this. I think I might actually be in this movie somewhere. Actually, a high school classmate of mine plays a character called Rocco's girlfriend. I don't think she has any lines, but forgot about that too until she showed up. That scene it goes back to what I was talking about before about that extremely specific New York flavor that Spike Lee can bring, but also because it's so specific, I think it's very universal that those details make it relatable to people who grew up around here, but also everyone else because of the texture that they create. And I think that's true of the timelessness tip as well. I want to close with a clip about this is another set of Italian American guys somewhat further down the food chain. Jackie Aprile Sr. et al. In the pizzeria, and one of their low-level drug dealer clients has developed a theory about who is actually the son of Sam. Here is clip 10.
I know who the killer is. I figured it out. Reggie Jackson.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
Serious. Son of Sam, Uncle Sam, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Bronx Bombers, New York fucking Yankees.
What, are you mixing acid with your dope now?
What kind of gun did the killer use? 44 caliber, right? What's Reggie's number? 44.
Hey, nobody said the killer was a Moulinard. Hey,
that's why they can't find him.
You keep talking like that, Woody. I'm putting you at the head of the fucking list. Give me the fucking list.
Stop.
Even if he is the fucking killer, we need to pull out
a serious list.
We need Reggie Jackson if we're going to win a World Series.
I mean, I mostly cut it for that guy being like, look, even if he is, so what? We need him on the roster, which was true.
Right. Yeah, that's Al Palagonia. That's one of Spike's close friends.
Oh, yeah?
Good old Al Palagonia.
I really love that scene because this is... I actually checked this with my dad, who I was raised in a Mets household, speaking of criminal enterprises. But, I mean, it's not like, you know, Mets fans had nothing else to think about in October, believe me, so... We definitely were paying attention to the Yankees. And I actually asked him, like, is this a thing? Or did Spike Lee just make this up? And my dad's like, oh, no, you would hear that from time to time. And I was like, really? And he said, you have to understand, people really thought Reggie Jackson could do anything. Which I thought was funny.
That's a good line. That was a good line.
Yeah, this is another reason that I dig this movie is that baseball is woven into it, which I'm never going to be mad at that. So,
yeah, and the Phil Rizzuto voiceover there is great.
Oh yeah,
towards the end of the film, I think when he Son of Sam kills his last victims, Phil Rizzuto is talking about the game, and you know, Spike Lee did so well with Dave Berkowitz setting up his final victim. So I thought that was a great touch. I didn't expect that, and it was a nice nod to 70s Yankees baseball and some of the icons from that generation.
Oh, for sure. Was that what do you call it? Was that a diegetic play by play, or was that done for the film? I don't remember.
It sounded like it was done for the film, but I don't remember when Phil Rizzuto passed. But it sounded like it was for the film because it was so clear. I mean, it sounded like it was recorded in a studio.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it actually did.
I would have to look back to see, or I guess we could just find out if it was recorded for the film. But it sounded like it was for the film and not something that he took from a game.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to look that up too, because now that I'm thinking about it, it's like, but on the other hand, it's so perfect that maybe it was just providential. Who knows?
Right.
So I wanted to ask one more thing about this and sort of the Spike Lee's sort of broader, I don't know how to put this, like a career-long decision to tell a story, scripted or unscripted, let's say. What would you think if he took another run at this story, at this crime story, unscripted? Do you think that would be something he'd be interested in doing? What would that look like? Would it kind of look the same?
No, I don't think he would. I mean, for him, he told this story, so it's time to tell a new story. Knowing him over the years, I don't think he's really interested in retelling the same story in a different manner. So I think for him, this narrative was told in the way that he wanted to tell it, and he's looking for new stories to tell. So I don't think he would ever do this as a documentary. And I'm not sure what could be gained from it. I guess it, you know, if the people that thought that the film was a mess, maybe there's something to make it more linear. But I mean, I don't know why Spike would feel compelled to do that. So
yeah,
I think he's always looking for the next. Yeah, I think he's always looking for the next story to tell, and the ones that he has told, he's proud of them, and he moves on to the next thing.
Yeah, I just selfishly would like another Spike Lee documentary. Why not a series? more content.
I'm sure you'll get one at some point. I'm sure there's something on the horizon.
Any last grand unifying or other thoughts about Summer of Sam?
No, I think we covered the main parts of it. Again, I think it's a great film. I think it's done really well, and I think he got some really strong performances out of it. I thought he had a great cast, and I think it's a really good story.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's told the way this story needed to be told. So I hope that more people revisit it and want to talk about it. And you can do that with me on Twitter at Blotter Presents. All right, before we leave you all, Randy.
In local news today, bees.
Where else can listeners find you and your work right now?
You can find me on Twitter at PamSson, PamSson. And you can go to my website, PamSson.com, to view most of my work, not all of my work, because my latest project is on Apple Plus, .. I actually did the Spike Lee episode. So if you have an Apple Plus subscription, or if you want to sign up, you can go to Apple Plus, sign up, or log in and check out Dear dot dot dot. And I directed the series premiere episode for that show. And the rest of my work can be found at pamsun.com. And excellent. I also have a baseball blog, Yankees blog, views from 314 feet. So you can check that out as well.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, that is it for us this week. Coming up next week, my Quaid in Full co-host and fellow Bart Layton superfan, Jeb Lund, and I will be talking about Fear City, New York City versus the Mafia. After that, there's a whole bunch of cons and frauds of the love and art variety. Until then, if you've got a tip for the Blotter Presents, like I said, I'm on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Today's episode was sponsored by Native and by Green Chef. Please check the show notes for links, and don't forget those promo codes. My guest was Randy Wilkins. He is on Twitter, like he said, at PAMSSON. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.